The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and I hope you've had a splendid Thanksgiving weekend. Our first guest tonight will be Ryan Merkley, the Chief Executive Officer of Creative Commons. You've seen those two small C's, the CC with the circle around it. It's embedded in Flickr and YouTube and many other places. I think we've all seen them. Well, they stand for Creative Commons, and tonight you'll get a new understanding of their significance.
The idea that we should make it easier for people to share their copyright if they want to. Most people don't know that almost everyone holds copyright. In today's copyright regime, from the minute you put pen to paper, the minute you create the fixed work, they call it, you have a copyright on that work for your life plus 70 years. You don't need to do anything. You don't have to register it. You don't have to mark it. It's yours.
And then I will be joined by Greg Lee, the president and CEO of Livestrong, the organization that was founded by cyclist Lance Armstrong. His doping and performance-enhancing drug scandal significantly impacted the organization's ability to raise funds. But they're on their road to recovery and continue to stay true to their mission.
To give you an example, you know, our revenues at one point in time maxed out at, you know, $50 million plus or minus. Yet today, with revenues that are 15 or 20% of that size, we're serving more than we ever have. We've gotten leaner and meaner and more efficient and more effective.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, November 26. 62% of American parents discuss charitable donations or volunteerism with their children, according to a study by the Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance. With an endowment of $37 billion, Harvard University has for decades firmly grasped the mantle of the world's richest school. However, that once insurmountable lead is looking vulnerable. Over the past decade, Harvard's endowment has grown less than 2%, while rivals have made bigger strides. Let me give you a few. The University of Pennsylvania, 96%, MIT, 47%, Princeton at 45%, Stanford at 44%, and Yale at 19%. So, a Good Must Grow poll asked Americans to name a socially responsible company or organization, and these were the five top responses, starting with fifth, Starbucks, then Goodwill, Google was third, Walmart second, and despite some bad publicity the last couple years, Red Cross is in the number one position. Giving circles are becoming an increasingly popular way for diverse groups of individual donors to support charities or projects of shared interest. This according to a report from the Collective Giving Research Group. Grants awarded by donor advised funds in the United States totaled a record of $15.75 billion in fiscal year 2016. That's a 10.4% from the previous year. 80% of nonprofits in a survey of salaries and staffing needs in New York, Philadelphia, and Washington plan to hire new staff members in 2018, and that's up from 57% who said so last year. Microsoft founder Bill Gates will invest $50 million in the Dementia Discovery Fund, a venture capital collaboration of charity, industry, and government groups focused on funding treatments for the disease. The investment comes personally from Gates and not from his philanthropic Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. However, Gates told Reuters that it will be followed by another personal donation of $50 million to startup ventures focused on Alzheimer's research. And finally, the treatment of nonprofits and giving in the new tax bill is a matter of great concern and interest. And covering the story for the Chronicle Philanthropy is Megan O'Neill. Good evening, Megan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
There's a lot here, so let's see if we can capture a few of the highlights. You open your story discussing the Johnson Amendment. What is that, and how is it treated in both the House and Senate version of the bill?
So the Johnson Amendment is a provision in IRS tax code that dates back to the 1950s that attempts to draw a bright line between civil society, nonpartisan organizations, and political engagement and political activity in this country. So it basically bars 501c3s from explicit or overt political activity, including endorsing political candidates and spending on political campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
Critics of it say it's a little bit fuzzy, that the IRS could have done done a better job sort of defining what qualifies as political activity. But a lot of nonprofit leaders say it's a really important part of ensuring that nonprofits can remain sort of nonpartisan organizations in their communities.
Mm-hmm. And is there any distinction between the two bills?
Yes. In fact, the House bill would loosen the Johnson Amendment. So it would allow for nonprofit entities to engage in some political activity of a de minimis amount is the language that's actually in the text. So this would mean that a nonprofit could endorse a political candidate within the sort of normal course of its typical operation. Mm. So if the nonprofit already puts out a monthly newsletter and then at the bottom of the newsletter they want to encourage the recipients of the newsletter to vote for X candidate, they could do that. Or if they have a monthly speaking series at a local church, they could invite a political candidate to come and make some statements at that sort of typical standing monthly meeting. But any political activity, according to the law, would have to stay within the sort of ordinary course of the nonprofit's activities and operations.
Gotcha. Now, the standard deduction that taxpayers take would be doubled, and that's included in each version of the bill. What would the impact of that be on giving?
That's correct. Both the House and the Senate versions of the legislation would double the standard deduction. There's a couple of pieces of analysis out now that say that that would have a really detrimental effect on charitable giving. It would reduce, according to one analysis, the number of American taxpayers who would take the standalone charitable deduction by 13 million people. And while we know people don't give only because of the charitable deduction, it is a motivator. So there's some analysis that says that it would depress charitable giving in the United States by $13.1 billion. I just saw another analysis the other day from the Tax Policy Center that's estimated that it would depress charitable giving by between $12 billion and $18 billion.
Wow. Well, there's been a number of issues that the nonprofit sector has been lobbying for, among them things such as a universal deduction for all taxpayers. How effective has the nonprofit lobby been up on the Hill this year?
You're absolutely right. There are a number of nonprofit lobby organizations here in Washington that have been pushing for many months running now this idea of taking the charitable deduction and putting it above the line. So this would be a deduction that would occur whether or not a taxpayer itemizes. They say that this would actually increase giving by a couple billion dollars. They say that it would sort of stoke this tradition of generosity and philanthropy in the United States. And there's been a little bit of traction. There's a Republican in the House named Republican Walker who actually wrote a bill that included language for this. And on the Senate side, actually, last week, Senator Lankford of Oklahoma also introduced legislation. But so far, the language has not made its way into either the House bill or the Senate bill. So the nonprofit lobby and some of the top leaders here in Washington have been rather ineffective getting anyone to sort of take that up.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of competition down there with groups with bigger war chests. Well, we're all watching to see what happens, if anything. Thanks for this report, Megan.
Thank you.
I'll be back to speak with Ryan Merkley of Creative Commons right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
How many of you seen those two small C's, CC, with a circle around it, on a picture or on a file or something, and have asked, I wonder what the significance of that is? If you have ever wondered, you'll wonder no more, thanks to my next guest. He is Ryan Merkley, the Chief Executive Officer of the nonprofit organization represented by those two C's, Creative Commons. Good evening, Ryan, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Creative Commons and the mission and objectives of the organization.
Sure. Creative Commons is an international nonprofit, and we are known best for being the creators of the CC licenses. They are a set of copyright licenses that allow people to share their works, if they wish, under a set of standard terms. Things like, you may use this work so long as you credit me and link back to the original, or you may use this work so long as you credit me, and you don't use it for a commercial purpose. I only want it for nonprofit purposes. We've made those licenses for about 16 years now. They have been used on just about every copyrightable work you can think of, about 1.2 billion works around the world. You've probably seen them embedded in tools or platforms that you use every day, things like Flickr or YouTube or SoundCloud. And our licenses are usually an option that you can select if you're someone who shares on those platforms.
Creative Commons was founded by Harvard Law School professor and political activist Larry Lessig. What inspired him to start this organization and movement?
I love this story because it's one where when something good coming out of something frustrating. A couple of weeks ago, I was at an open education conference that was in Anaheim, California, and we were talking about being so close to Disney. And it's really, in a strange way, Walt Disney's fault that we exist. It was the 1998 Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act, an act of Congress to extend the term of copyright from life plus 50 years to life plus 70 years that got us all into this in the first place. Lawrence Lessig, our founder, was frustrated that Congress was going to extend that term, not just for new works, but actually retroactively to everything that had been created before.
That's insane.
And he thought that was unfair. And so he fought a case all the way to the Supreme Court, what's known as the Eldred case. And when Eldred agreed to be part of that case, he said, if you're going to do this, I want you to do something to make copyright easier for people so that it's not just a lawsuit. Now, in the end, Lawrence and Eldred lost that case. But CC was born as a result. The idea that we should make it easier for people to share their copyright if they want to. Most people don't know that almost everyone holds copyright. In today's copyright regime, from the minute you put pen to paper, the minute you create the fixed work, they call it, you have a copyright on that work for your life plus 70 years. You don't need to do anything. You don't have to register it. You don't have to mark it. It's yours for a period of time that almost feels like forever, because by the time you're dead and then 70 years pass, very rarely does that work have a lot of relevance to the world. And certainly that urgent relevance that comes from current culture is long gone.
So our listeners are listening to a copyrighted broadcast, correct?
They are.
So how does this work in practice, Ryan? Suppose I've written something or uploaded a photo on Flickr and want to share it now in some way through Creative Commons. What do I need to do?
So there are two ways. The first is if you're using a platform like a Flickr or a YouTube that already has CC tools built into the platform, when you upload, you'll have a choice. And so I'm a Flickr user, and so I upload my photo, and I have an option to change a setting that says, what permissions do I want to give people so that they can use, without asking, my work under those terms? And so I like to use CC BY, which means you can use my work as long as you credit me, and you link back to the original work that I shared. So I use that all the time. And lots of people do that. That's actually one of our most popular licenses.
You said there are 1.2 billion licenses on Creative Commons.
Yeah.
Do you consider that to be a lot or a little?
The short answer is both. There are trillions of works around the world. And because copyright is automatic, every work that enters the world is born closed. It is born locked down by what we call all rights reserved copyright or standard copyright, which really just means no one can use your work unless you give them explicit permission. And so in one sense, 1.2 billion is very small compared to the grand scope of all the things that humans have created. In the other sense, it's a huge deal because over a period of 15 years, in every single case, someone had to choose to share, and they had to decide to set that default from closed to open. And the fact that people have done that over 1.2 billion times, I think, is remarkable.
Yeah.
The short answer is it's both. It's a big deal, or it's a lot, and it's a little.
Mm-hmm. And I think a big deal for Creative Commons was earlier this year when the Metropolitan Museum of Art added 375,000 images.
Yeah, that was a spectacular moment and a very long It was a spectacular moment and also the end of a very long project for us working with the Met to get there. So the Metropolitan Museum of Art has digital versions of works that are already in the public domain. And while it may seem obvious that every institution should share those things because they're already open, that isn't often the case. And they make investments in order to share them. But we want them to put those works out there so that everybody can use them. And so what the Met decided to do was share their digital collection of public domain works under this what we call the CC0 public domain dedication, which is zero restrictions, no credit, no link, nothing. You can just use it. And really, that's how the public domain is supposed to work. The copyright isn't like other property. It's meant to be the right of copyright is a a balance between the public's rights and the creator's rights. And eventually that term was supposed to end. And what happened when it ended is that everybody got it because everything is built on top of everything that came before it. And so what the Met did was wonderful. We were very excited that they did it. And we hope that it will lead other institutions to follow along. And there are other institutions that have done it as well, like the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam.
That's great news. You operate in dozens and dozens of countries across the world. How do you create a legal framework that addresses all the specific laws of each one of these countries?
Very carefully. We do it primarily in collaboration. So the CC license tools, when they began, when that small group of mostly lawyers were in a basement at Stanford inventing the license tools, they built the licenses for the United States and the U.S. legal context. And then over time, worked with legal experts country by country to port the licenses. It's a term we borrow from software, which really just means adapt to a different legal context. And so in the early days of CC, the first three versions of the licenses, you would have the U.S. license and then you would have a ported license for another country, so the CC license for Canada or the CC license for India. About 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, I guess, CC completed a two-year collaborative process with all of our international affiliates to create one license, the International 4.0 license. And so now we have one legal license that considers all the legal contexts around the world so that you can use that license anywhere. And so when you license a work in China, that work is covered by copyright in the U.S., and vice versa.
That's a Herculean task. Congratulations on that. And that's what you're trying to do with everything, and that is make it simple for the user. And that certainly does it. Let's get back to copyright law a little bit, because it is a bit ironic that in this age where everything is accessible and people are creating in collaboration, a lot of that due to the internet and cell phones, these copyright laws, as you described, are so darn restrictive. Is there any hope or chance of changing that?
Well, I'm hopeful, and it's certainly a big part of the work that Creative Commons does. One of the things that we try to do is make copyright laws more reflective of the way people actually create and share. Today's laws were more or less written for large rights holders. And to be fair, in the beginning, that's how they were written as well. The copyright laws were originally written for book publishers at a time when pretty much the only way that you could copy something is if you owned a printing press. That world has changed dramatically, obviously. And even since Creative Commons began, the idea that every single person would carry a device that could shoot HD video in their pocket was not on the table. The idea of social media, that we would all share photos all day long, was not a thing that even we contemplated in 2001 when CC was just getting started. You know, social media didn't come into the forefront until the mid-2000s. So the world has dramatically changed. Everyone is a copyright holder. But not only is everyone a copyright holder, but everyone is making things that are worth sharing.
Yeah.
And that they want to share. And today's laws don't reflect that remotely. And so the people end up in scenarios where they are essentially violating copyright all day long. They're making, as Cory Doctorow says, 1,000 copies before breakfast.
That's just
because
right.
that's how copyright or how the internet works. It's based on copies.
Mm-hmm.
We need something smarter than that. What's frustrating is that most of these debates are led by large rights holders protecting their specific interests, and there's very little discussion about regular everyday people who are making copies all day long and who are making copyrighted works all day long, whether they want to or not, and they need tools to share.
Yeah, and to put this in a little bit of context, I believe that a patent is only good for, what, 20 years?
That's right.
So this just shows the insanity of how this is compared to something like that. And let me ask you one last question about that. In the front of all the books that I read so often or at the end of a television show, I see these words, all rights reserved. Mm-hmm. What does that mean exactly?
So all rights reserved is standard copyright. It's automatic from the moment that the work is fixed or the work is created. And so that term of copyright in the U.S. is your life plus 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
That term varies a little bit around the world. So in Canada, where I'm from, it's life plus 50 years. In Mexico, it's life plus 100 years. It's a very, very long time. And during that period of time, the author of the work has an exclusive right. All of their rights are reserved to them. And so the only way you can use that work is if the author specifically grants you the right to use it.
Mm-hmm. You know, like any organization, there are going to be some who are going to be a little less enthusiastic about your work than others. And I would suspect one of those would be the academic publishing industry. Mm-hmm. Tell us how they operate and why they might see Creative Commons as being detrimental to their business model.
So Creative Commons in that story is the enabler for sharing. And so in some senses, they may have a frustration with Creative Commons, but really what they're frustrated with is that they have an antiquated business model whose time, I might argue, is reaching an end. For those that don't know, the way that academic publishing works generally is that researchers get money to do research.
Right.
Usually they get that money in whole or in part from public institutions or governments. Then they seek an opportunity to publish that work in a journal. Those journals are usually privately owned, and those journals require the author, in order to get peer-reviewed and published, to submit their work for free, to assign their copyright to the publisher, so they have to give away their copyright. Mm. And then the publisher does peer review, usually with volunteer editors who are, in their own right, noted academics who do that work for free. And then the publisher sells access to those works back to the academic and the scientific community. Either they do it by charging large, usually undisclosed fees to academic libraries, or they do it by charging about $30 to $40 per article for people to read it. If that sounds a little bit ridiculous, it's because it is. What we're actually talking about is the public funds research.
Yeah.
The researchers do the research.
Mm-hmm.
Then a private company pays them nothing for their work, pays nothing to the editors, and then charges everybody to read the work we already paid for.
A premium price at that.
Yes. If we believe in open knowledge, if we believe that access to information and knowledge leads to greater discovery and innovation, this is the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really a moral case. But in that story, CC is just the tool that is most commonly used for what's called open access research, so that those works can be freely used. You know, we are, you know, in that story, CC is one of the leading advocates. But the real point of frustration and the real point of challenge is a community of academics and researchers who want to get to discovery faster and who don't understand why they don't have access to the things that they need. And that's true all over the world, and maybe even more true in the Global South, where they don't have access to the research they want. They don't have the privilege of walking into an academic library where they have full access because their institution pays those fees. But everyone is struggling with this. You know, Germany is saying they're going to stop paying these exorbitant rates. Even Harvard has talked about how they can't afford the library fees that they pay in order to access these works. And largely this is research that was done for free by these researchers, paid for by all of us.
Yeah, by the government or whoever it may be. And I guess a real impetus for change were coming from people like the Gates Foundation, correct?
Yeah. I think the Gates Foundation has been a real leader in this. They are obviously a foundation that gives out grant money in order to do research. And what they have said very recently is that if you receive a grant from us, $1 or $1 million, we're going to require that the research you publish is openly available on day one to everyone. And they require a CC license to be applied to that work. That's a really powerful statement.
Sure is.
It's also forcing some really important conversations about how you sustain and engage in the academic model with openness at the center of it. But it's starting to get to some of the other interesting questions about how do we do replicability? Because just the paper, because it's not just the paper that you need. You often also need the underlying data that explains it, because at the core of science is the ability to replicate the discoveries that other researchers have made. And you can't do that if you can't see the data that backs up the assertions that are in the paper.
Right. Be a lot of redundancy. Well, at the end of 2015, as your organization continued to evolve, Creative Commons shifted its organizational strategy and you created a new vision. Tell us why that was necessary and what is this new vision?
Creative Commons has been at this for over 15 years, and in the earlier days, you know, the goal was an established license that was respected and applied around the world, that held up under legal scrutiny and that operated globally. And we've done that work. And we focused very much on adoption of those licenses, to getting them embedded in the places where people share content. And we think we've done much of that work as well. Question was, how do we realize the vision of access, equity, innovation, and discovery? What we want all this content to enable. We want people to have this shared content so they can make great things, so they can create new discoveries. And so what do we need to do that? And so we've shifted our strategy towards what we call a vibrant, usable commons powered by collaboration and gratitude.
Mm.
We think that that metric is how we figure out if we are enabling that access, that equity, that discovery and innovation, and how we drive people to share more and engage with each other, because that's at the heart of why we do this. These works are not meant to sit alone in an archive. They're meant to be used. That is their express purpose. And so we want to enable that kind of use.
Yeah. And a big part of that in 2017 has been something called CC Search. And this carries with it tremendous applications. Tell us what the problem has been and how CC Search will begin to address it.
CC's success is also now its greatest challenge. So one of the smartest decisions our founders made was to embed CC tools in the places where people already work so that you didn't have to come to the CC website to get a license.
Mm-hmm.
The downside of that today, when you reach 1.2 billion works and CC-licensed content on over 9 million websites, is that everything is all over the place.
Yeah. How do you index that?
Right. So we're going to try and solve that problem.
Wow.
We want to create a complete index of the commons, 1.2 billion works, probably going on 2 billion or even 5 billion as the commons continues to grow. We want to index where those works are, what they are, and what's called the metadata, which is really just the descriptive data that says, what is this work? What do we know about it? What kind of file is it? What are the words that describe it if it's an image, which allows it to be searched? So the first thing is you make that catalog, that index. The second is you write a little bit of software called an API that allows anybody to build a service that can talk to that database and ask it questions. You can use that then to create a service like search, or you can use it to do things like research, or you can do really exciting things like apply machine learning or AI tools to it to enhance the commons. You know, there was a period in history when one person could actually know everything, and that period is long past. No single person could sit down and read everything. But there are computers that can read everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if we make it accessible to them, they can aid us in discovering the things that are in the commons, whether it's looking for patterns in the compendium of academic research and scientific discovery, or whether it's understanding imagery or video and finding new ways to manipulate it. If we unlock that, there's so much more potential for this vibrant, usable commons that we talk about. So that's CC Search. It's a catalog. It's some software that lets you talk to the catalog. And it's the front end, which is the search tool that lets you find what you're looking for and use it more easily.
What's the time frame on that?
So we shipped the beta or published the beta in February. You mentioned the Met. We actually made that announcement at the Met concurrent with their release of that great content. We'll be revising that beta based on hundreds of user feedback form completions. That'll be shipped by the end of the year. And we're going to open that API, that software that anybody can use to talk to the database in early next year.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as part of the vision that you just mentioned, was that piece where you talked about gratitude and that you really wanted to create a joy to contribute to the commons, which perhaps had been missing. Describe how you're changing the experience of the contributor.
So right now, the experience of giving to the commons can be pretty lonely. You upload your photo, and then you sort of wait to see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know lots of people who, particularly in the photo space, use reverse image search to try to find out where their images ended up. Because, you know, the reason people share is because they want those works to be used, and there's very little that comes back to them. And so we started working on this idea of gratitude. I was inspired by a researcher at MIT named Nate Matias, who was doing work around how communities work together. And we were talking about this idea of gratitude. We take this idea very broadly. For me, gratitude is as simple as giving credit to someone for their work, which is fundamental to every CC license. Every CC license requires that you give credit to the author.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the least you can do when you use someone's work is warmly credit them as the author so that people know they made it. And ideally link back to that original work so the next person can find it and perpetrate that sharing, that cycle of sharing. So gratitude's about that, but gratitude's also about how we want to work together. Now, much of the commons collaboration is asynchronous. I put it out there and years later you find it and put it in your project. But some of it is direct. And how can we facilitate that? How can we help creators find other creators, thank other creators, encourage other creators through communities of practice, those kinds of things? So that's how we want to do that. The simplest thing that we started with in CC Search was doing one-click attribution in the tool so that when you find the work, you no longer have to do a kind of complicated process to do attribution. It's one click, and there you go. And we think that that will make it easier for people to do attribution, to credit those authors, and that makes it more likely, which enhances that experience.
That's eliminating one big roadblock, I'll tell you that. That's just great.
Yeah.
You're a nonprofit organization.
We are.
How are you financed, and what are your major revenue streams?
So Creative Commons is a U.S.-based 501c3, so we're a U.S. charity, and we are funded primarily through grants and individual donations. Our revenue stream has changed a little bit over the last number of years. I joined the organization at a time of some financial difficulty with a focus on shoring that up. And so we have added a couple of new revenue streams, still in the sort of philanthropy side. So we have a much stronger individual donor program than we ever had before. And so we have been reaching out to individual creators and people who share our values to invite them to support our work. And they do that every day, especially through our year-end campaign, which many nonprofits run a year-end campaign, and ours will start sometime in November. And then also through sponsorship, we run a summit, which is our kind of annual gathering of the open movement who work with CC Tools, and we fund that event through sponsorship, which was something we hadn't done before, and so invited companies and partners to come to the table around that. And then we have a number of generous grant funders who support our work, both on a project-based format and also as a general operating support format.
Love that general operating support.
We do. We're grateful.
And you joined the organization from Mozilla, where you had been the chief operating officer, and you'd work with the mayor of Toronto on open data, and you'd also had a stint with the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. How did those experiences help inform the work you do now?
There were a lot of experiences in there. I think about my work in politics a lot. There is an urgency in politics because you have a closing window of time. And there is a respect for the public that is baked into that, both because that's your job, but also because if you don't, they will remind you that you ought to. And that has always kind of guided me in my work, that there's a public trust for both governments and for nonprofits, an expectation that this privilege that we have to work in this space requires us to govern ourselves a certain way. CC is what we call a radically open organization. We do our work in the open. Our strategy is public. You can see our agenda and our work plans. Anyone can join many of our public projects. All of our code is shared openly on the software projects I mentioned. And that creates, we think, an opportunity to be powered by a movement and by contribution. I think that's why CC has been so successful. It is harder to work that way, I'll be candid, but we think it makes us better. And so, you know, the things that I learned, Mozilla, which is also an open source organization, and the makers of Firefox, my work in government both had that openness and that public accountability baked into their DNA. And so that has always stayed with me. And I've always worked in organizations where that was an element of what we do.
Yeah, let's talk about your organization and the corporate culture at Creative Commons, picking up on what you just said. How would you describe that work culture? And Ryan, as a CEO, what specific things do you do to influence it and shape it?
So Creative Commons is today a fully virtual organization, which comes with a unique culture. We at one time had an office in San Francisco and then later in Mountain View. And when I took over the organization, we had staff in the Bay Area, but also staff all over. I'm based in Toronto, and I wasn't going to relocate to the Bay Area for this job. So that meant on day one, the CEO was remote. But my experience at Mozilla definitely taught me that in any environment, when one person is remote, everyone is remote. Because the ways in which you structure a meeting, the ways in which you engage people require you to accommodate the remote participant to make sure you get their best work. And so that influenced the way that we work as a culture, because our staff mostly work from home or go to co-working spaces in order to do their work. The upside of that is I can hire great people wherever they are.
Yep.
And so I have staff in the U.S., staff in Canada. I have a community manager who lives in Kenya. I have a director of partnerships and strategy who's based in Chile. And so I have the privilege of hiring those people because I don't require them to relocate. The challenge of that is I have people in the U.S. and Kenya and Chile
absolutely.
Who work all over
the
world.
Oh, another side of the coin.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we do the time zone shuffle and we coordinate those meetings. We do our work largely by video conferencing in order to stay engaged. And we use communications tools like Slack, which is essentially just live chat in order to keep people connected. But you talked about work culture. You know, because we're an open organization, there is a permeability between the staff and community. So I mentioned the Slack channel. There are over 1,000 people in our Slack channel. They are not employees. The CC organization has less than 20 full-time employees, but we work and integrate with that community all day long in a variety of channels and collaborative structures. And so that creates a very different culture. I try to model that work. You asked what I do. I try to work openly and be accessible and encourage people to engage me directly. I spend a lot of time working directly with the community, and I try and spend time making sure that my staff see my work, that they understand the decisions that I'm making, because they don't have the opportunity to stand with me at the water cooler every day or just have those informal conversations. And so I sometimes have to be a bit more obvious or direct about a decision that I'm making or a process that I'm thinking through, so that when I get to that point, they know how I got there and they come with me. And so that has been a learned skill over time. I learned some of that at Mozilla, which is also a remote and office-based organization. So Mozilla has a number of satellite offices but also has remote staff. And I think we've refined it a lot at Creative Commons.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, let me close with this, Ryan. You know, some of this can be a little technical and legal, but this past year, your State of the Commons report, you highlighted impact stories, the human impacts of the global projects that benefit from Creative Commons. Why don't you close by giving us one or two of those stories?
You know, there's so many pieces that are powerful to me, and because the Commons reaches across so many content types, it's hard to pick one. I'll mention two. One, I want to speak about a volunteer at Creative Commons named Basil Kardabil, who's Syrian. And then I want to talk a little bit about cancer research. I'll speak them very quickly. Basil Kardabil was a Syrian volunteer who, as part of his passion, archived 3D digital versions of the ancient structures of Palmyra. And he was taken by the government in 2012. And actually, just this year, we learned that he was actually murdered by the government in 2015, executed by them. And his 3D models remain. And we were actually able to reprint one of those 3D models at our most recent summit, working with a U.S.-based 3D printing company, Re3D.
Mm-hmm.
We printed it 8.5 feet tall. It was 250 pounds. And 1/10 the size of the original structure. And we were able to kind of bring this new Palmyra back to life. And I think there's something very powerful about someone creating something that lives on. That structure, the original structure, is gone. It was destroyed by ISIS as they've been working their way across Syria, destroying monuments. And so now that's one of the only versions of that work that exists. And if someone had not done that and shared it openly, it would be gone forever.
Wow.
This is very moving to me.
Sure is.
The second is, you know, I had the opportunity to work a little bit with former Vice President Joe Biden and the Cancer Moonshot through some work that we did advocating for more open research. And one of the things that we did was we invited people to tell us why open access to research would matter to them. Why should regular people care about this? And I expected that I would hear from doctors and who want access to research or other researchers who are trying to find discovery. And the thing that really struck me is I heard from families. I was not prepared for what they would write us. And they talked about how they were trying to be advocates for their mothers and their daughters and their husbands in finding the latest research and giving good information so they could get the right care and so that they could access what they needed to extend their lives or to have a better quality of life. And this is what stands between researchers and patients, is these paywalls and barriers that prevent them from living better lives or living longer lives.
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't anything I can see someone argue that would justify keeping that information from people. That's why we do the work that we do, because of regular people every day who are trying to live better lives. And we think that open knowledge and open culture can lead us there.
Well, Ryan Merkley, the Chief Executive Officer of Creative Commons, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Your website is creativecommons.org. What will people find there, and how can they become engaged with the organization?
At creativecommons.org, you'll find lots of information about how the licenses work and how they can be applied. You'll also find tools that you can use if you're trying to make something. For example, I talked about search, and at ccsearch.creativecommons.org, you'll find that tool we talked about, where you can punch in the thing that you're looking for and find tools to access it.
Thanks, Ryan. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
I'm grateful. Thank you very much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
With nearly one in four New Yorkers struggling to meet their most basic needs, we know our city is facing a crisis. But did you know that our highest poverty rates are among women and mothers? These women don't need handouts. They need a hand up. That's why Grameen America provides tens of thousands of women across our city with the loan capital they need to start their own small businesses. With the gift of entrepreneurship, these women have the opportunity to escape poverty, provide for their children, and gain independence. Join the movement today. Invest in New York City by investing in them. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
Livestrong, the cancer group founded by Lance Armstrong, has certainly been through a tumultuous period. As a result of the doping and performance-enhancing drug scandal that engulfed its founder, the organization saw its revenues fall from $46 million in 2011 to $6.2 million in 2015. But Livestrong has proven to be resilient, and revenues are slowly making their way back up there, and its essential work continues. And this is all being led by my next guest. He is Greg Lee, the president and CEO of the Livestrong Foundation. Good evening, Greg, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you very much, Denver. Glad to be here.
You know, there are quite a number of cancer organizations across America, national, local, some international. What is unique and distinctive about Livestrong that helps set you apart from those other organizations?
Well, you hit on a very valid point. There's some 35,000 public charities that declare cancer as their choice of or their issue of and topic of choice. The thing that's unique about Livestrong is we focus not on the disease, but on the person who has the disease. And our initiatives and our programs and our efforts are aimed at the individual, the patient, the caregiver, the family, and all of those that are dealing with the disease. And we leave the science and the biology and the medicine to the doctors and those who really know more about it than we do.
That's a nice focus. Well, there are certainly risks when an organization is so closely tied to an individual, as Livestrong was with Lance Armstrong. So when that individual's reputation takes a hit, so does the reputation of the organization, simply because the public associates the two in their mind. How did you and the board deal with this, and what steps did you take to address it?
Very valid point, Denver, and you make, a perfect example. We were about not just cancer, about fighting the disease, but we were also had a celebrity as a namesake.
Mm-hmm.
And you rise and fall with that celebrity. I think the thing that we began to focus on is realizing that this was not about the bike. It was not about a guy in a cycling career. It's about cancer and the millions of people around the country and around the globe that are fighting through that disease. And quite frankly, what we found is that they don't care about what a guy did on a bike 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. They call today because they need help.
Mm-hmm.
They're visiting the website today because they need help, and they know we will provide that to them. So I think the biggest thing that we did was begin to focus on the patient. In fact, if you look at our organization chart, it has the patient right in the center, and everything else, you know, surrounds that. It's all with the patient right in the middle of things.
That becomes your mantra. That becomes your entire focus. Well, many nonprofits are going to be faced at one time or another of having to cut staff and sharpen their focus around those programs that are essential to the core mission of the organization. And you certainly have had to do that. I know you had staff of about 119. You took it down to 35. What lessons have you learned, Greg, taking on this difficult assignment and doing so in a very effective way?
I think sometimes organizations can get caught up in being bigger.
Hmm.
They can be caught up in trying to do more and not focus on doing better. To give you an example, you know, our revenues at one point in time maxed out at, you know, $50 million plus or minus. Yet today, with revenues that are 15 or 20% of that size, we're serving more than we ever have. We've gotten leaner and meaner and more efficient and more effective. And again, I think sometimes people get so focused on bigger and better or bigger and faster that they don't think about, well, how can I do it more efficiently? How can I do it more effectively? How can I be more focused? You know, at one point in time, we had 26, 27 programs. Today, we have 5.
Yeah.
And we do those 5 really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide high-quality, comprehensive care to those people who need it in those 5 areas. And we let others take care of those other surrounding programs. And so I think for us, it was an exercise in focus and in on quality, not necessarily just quantity.
Yes, this crisis has actually made you probably a better organization in so many different ways. Well, I want to turn to those programs in a minute, but first, tell us how many Americans are currently living with cancer, and how has that picture changed for survivors, let's say, compared to what it was a decade or two ago?
You know, right now there's about 15.5 million Americans that are going through a cancer diagnosis. And when I started in this field 11 years ago now, the number we always talked about was 10.5, and then it was 11.5, and then it was 12, and then it was 14, and now it's 15.5 million. And you don't have to be a real math major to figure out that, okay, well, that means in the last decade it's gone up by a third.
Yeah.
I think people are living longer, their life expectancy is longer, and as a result, more are being diagnosed. The stats used to be 1 in 3 people. Now it's really about 1 in 2.4 people are going to be diagnosed with cancer during their lifetime. And so those are the facts that we're dealing with.
Yeah. You know, every individual and family, of course, is very, very different. But is there a somewhat typical trajectory that people go through when they hear the words, you've got cancer, for the very first time?
There really is. I mean, and understand, we help north of 300,000 people a year, and yet I can almost put these in certain phases. The first thing that usually happens is just shock. They almost feel like they've been hit upside the head with a 2x4 or something. You know, I call it the whack on the side of the head. And they feel that way. And usually they feel that way for sometimes a period of days, sometimes a period of weeks, depending upon their stage of diagnosis, et cetera. But then the second phase usually is you know what, this is my life, and dang it, I'm going to do something about it.
Yeah.
And so there is a kind of a recovery phase that they come out of where there's energy, there's motivation, there's inspiration that says, hey, wait a minute, it's my life. I'm going to live strong. I'm going to take control of it. I guess the third phase is I'm going to find out everything I can. And so there's this education process, and there's this learning process, and this acting like a sponge to soak it all up. And then the next phase is probably one that says, this is hard as hell. You know, I've learned a lot. I know a lot. But there's kind of a back to reality that says, yeah, I'm motivated and I'm inspired and I want to take control. And I've got a lot of information.
But this is tough.
This is tough. It still doesn't make it easy. And so once they're back in that reality, then they kind of level set and they're really mature. They're balanced. They have kind of equal parts of motivation, knowledge, awareness. And they're really kind of in a spot where they can deal with it effectively. So that's a quick summary from my viewpoint.
That's a good rundown. Well, one of the things you've done, you've developed something called the Live Strong Guidebook, which assists cancer survivors navigate the physical and emotional and practical concerns that they may encounter during this cancer journey. Give us an idea of the kind of information that's in that guidebook.
Our guidebook that you point out, Denver, is actually 2 volumes. And the first is a guidebook. And it literally is a one-stop shop where you can find information and resources that are available. And it attempts to be pretty agnostic to the type of cancer you have. As you may know, cancer is not one type. There's 200 plus different types of diagnoses. And as a result, this tries to be a little bit more generic about what cancer is, what it means, what are the steps that you'll go through, what kinds of logical sequences make sense for you to do, and where can you get information. I think the other element that's an important part of that guidebook that we found that people needed was what we call a journal or that second set, which is really a way for people to have kind of a central repository. It sounds like a big word or big frame, but they need a place to keep all the stuff, whether it's notes or receipts or doctor visit things or appointments or contact information for everybody. And so we put together this journal that is literally a binder that allows people to organize and structure and maintain and keep all their stuff. On day one, about all they know is I've got a doctor appointment and I need to show up at the doctor appointment. You know, day 180, there's 180 pieces of stuff.
Yeah.
And where do they put it all and how do they keep it all organized? And so that journal is kind of an important ancillary document for them to keep, just to have everything accessible and right at hand.
Yeah, it's great to have, because I think also sometimes when people are going through this, they're not listening always attentively as they should, and because they're scared. So being able to collect all that information someplace is a godsend. One of your signature programs is a partnership you forged with the YMCA in communities across this country. Tell us about Live Strong at the YMCA.
You know, one of the things that's different about LiveStrong is that we don't just sit in an incubator in Austin, Texas and come up with programs. We listen to cancer constituents. We survey them. We ask them what are their problems, what are their challenges, what are the gaps that they see. And years ago, the results of our surveys kept coming back that, you know, I finished my cancer treatment, but I don't have any strength. You know, I've got a daughter that's getting married in 10 weeks, and I want to be able to get up off the couch and walk her down the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've got some other activity that I want to I want to go play golf with my buddies again, and I don't have the strength or the quality of life that I want to have. What do I do about that? And we kept hearing this and kept hearing it and kept hearing it. And so we had a group of staff members go to Stanford University, learn and train. They spent about 3 months walking through an education program. They used their knowledge, what they learned at Stanford, to develop a free 12-week recovery program that would help cancer survivors post-treatment kind of get back up on their feet.
Mm.
And to date now, you point out, we have about 625 YMCA locations around the country. We've had more than 52,000 people go through that program. It's a free 12-week recovery program to really be able to get people, you know, out of the bed, back on their feet, and back into the active lives, and kind of restore the quality of life that they all want to have.
Yeah, just a great partnership. I think we so often think of partnerships between nonprofits and corporations, but there's a lot of them between nonprofits and nonprofits, and this is one of the better ones.
This was a terrific example of us having the curriculum and having the program, and the YMCA having a broad network of facilities and infrastructure and a perfect marriage of two like-minded organizations to have a terrific program.
As you know, Greg, there are more than 150,000 people of reproductive age who are diagnosed with cancer each year. And to assist that population, you have the LiveStrong Fertility Program. What kind of support does that provide?
You know, one of the areas, again, that is one of these gaps in services that we see in the cancer continuum is specialized services to young women, young couples, young men as they go through their reproductive years. Oftentimes, their clinician and their doctor will talk to them about cancer and what they need to do to treat it, but they don't talk about, well, God, you're young. Do you want to have children? And what does that mean? And if you want to have a family, what does that look like? And are there steps that you can take? And even if they do talk about it, the fertility process, the preservation process, the fertility stimulation process, things like that cost $25,000 or $30,000. And if you're a young adult or a young couple who may have just graduated from college or just may have bought your first car or house or beginning a family together, to tack on, first of all, you have a cancer diagnosis, but then to try to say, well, if you want to have a family, it's going to cost you $30,000 or $40,000 out of your pocket. People just can't afford that.
Yeah.
So this is another one of those gaps that we took aim at that really provides technical assistance, advice, and counseling, but we also have a network of about 660 community cancer centers around the country that will help them with their fertility needs at significant discounts.
Mm-hmm.
We have a partnership with EMD Serona that helps provide medications. And as a result of that, this year alone, we've already served over 1,350 couples. We saved them north of $10 million in their costs. And literally, the fun part about that, and I've been with the organization long enough, that people that I met within the first year or two that were single at the time, that were diagnosed, that went through a fertility exercise with us, are now coming out the other end, and they've got twins, they've got a young baby on the way, and things like that. So it's amazing to see kind of that full circle.
Very sweet. I think it was in 2014 that LiveStrong made a 10-year $50 million commitment to the Dell Medical Center at the University of Texas. What specifically are you funding, and where do you stand with that?
You know, all of our activities and initiatives prior to this investment, I would call reactive, meaning that we were making an investment to help people who were diagnosed with cancer. We were making an investment to help people get back on their feet with a recovery program, like with the LiveStrong YMCA. But in our mind, those kinds of services ought to be all about the treatment. Why is it that the average person learns more about their insurance 6 or 8 months after a diagnosis when they've got a dining room table full of invoices and receipts and insurance bills? And so our investment with the University of Texas and the Dell Medical School was really a way to proactively change the focus and have the patient educated on day one about their insurance. And they know what it covers. And if the best place to get a mammogram is across town because it's less expensive, then let's do that.
Yep.
Let's plan to do that. If the best cause of treatment is this or that, then let's plan to do that. Let's focus everything on the patient. And I think the advantage that we had with the Dell Medical School is it was new. And you're able to start with a blank sheet of paper and start programs with the patient in the center. There are many institutions that are working really hard to put the patient in the center, but for so long they've had a mechanism and an infrastructure that put the disease in the center. And even though they're trying to tweak and twist and turn to refocus that, it just takes longer to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really excited about being able to put the patient in the center to be able to focus not so much on the tumor, but the patient who has the tumor.
Right.
And really put them at the forefront. And for us, it's just a way to proactively look at the cancer trajectory and do something that will be good for the cancer community long term, not just these short term things that we're doing with navigation or fitness with the YMCA.
As I mentioned earlier, you are building your fundraising up again. How are you doing it? And what are some of the different streams of revenue that you have that help support the work of the organization?
I think the one thing that we continually learn about fundraising is that it doesn't just start with fundraising. It starts with education.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with awareness. If you tell people and you do a better job of explaining to people what you do and why you do it and why it's important and what impact it has in changing or saving lives, people are more likely to give of their time, of their energy, and of their resources and funds. So part of our effort was really focused on here's what we do and here's why it's important. The second thing that we realized is that we have to provide channels of revenue and opportunities that kind of meet donors where they are. Some of them want to participate in events. As an example, here a few weeks ago, we had a team participating in the New York Marathon that was raising money for the cancer fight. So there are some people who want to participate in events, and that is their way to donate. There are others who want to participate in maybe a workplace giving program where they have a small amount taken out of a paycheck every period. There's others who want to fund specific programs. There's others who want to buy merchandise. There's others, you know, who want to make endowments and large one-time gifts for very specific purposes. And again, what we try to do, Denver, is have a menu of options that will really help cater to each different type of donor to kind of meet them where they are. And we found that to be really successful. But I think it all starts with really, here's what we're doing, here's why it's important, and why we need you to step up and help us. And I think that's really primarily what has helped us turn the corner on our fundraising success.
Yeah, and major gifts are a big part of that. And I know you recently had your first $1 million major gift, and that is quite the milestone.
Literally had the first $1 million gift in the last 10 years. I can tell you that since then we've had several $250,000
mm-hmm.
gifts, several $50,000 and $100,000 gifts. So it's amazing how that snowball begins to roll. Once people begin to understand, here's what the foundation is doing, here's the good work, here's the impact, and then they usually want to step up and help.
Let me close with this, Greg. Earlier this year, you celebrated Live Strong Day as part of your 20th anniversary by commemorating the iconic yellow wristband. What is the story behind that wristband, and what has it meant to the organization over the years?
Well, first of all, that wristband has been phenomenal for our organization, and that's an understatement. We've now distributed somewhere north of 90 million of those around the globe. It meant a lot to us in terms of fundraising, but I think the other thing was just more hope and inspiration and awareness. It really started quite easily. You know, we were kind of going through a lull where we're trying to find something, a way to share with the community what Live Strong was about, some way to give people something to latch hold of. And Nike, one of our partners at the time, was tasked with an idea of coming up with a solution, an idea. They've got a marketing team and a brilliant group of folks. And they had silicon bands that they used for basketball teams in inner cities, and they called them baller bands at that time. And so they thought about the idea of coming up with a baller band that was in yellow, kind of symbolic of the yellow associated with professional cycling. And they thought that might be a way to kind of have something that could be iconic.
They were right.
They were exactly right. At that time, then we started off on a mission to figure out, okay, what do we put on that band?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, coincidentally, the foundation was going through a process to identify the name of a program that would cater to survivors that were going through a battle and trying to give them a hope and inspiration and resources and information. And the team internally landed on LiveStrong as the name of that program.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second that other people said, well, wait a minute, I hear this LiveStrong term, wow, that might be the best thing to put on a wristband in addition to just the yellow silicon that really promotes what the organization's about. So that's kind of a short story on fast forward to how we got where we're at.
And you just distributed another 100,000 of them back in May to Cancer Warriors, so it lives on.
Exactly right. We had a promotion around LiveStrong Day, and literally more than 100,000 people took us up on that benefit. And so now there's 100,000 more out there that are wearing those wristbands.
Fantastic. Well, Greg Lee, the President and CEO of the LiveStrong Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, what visitors will find there, and how they can become involved with your organization.
Thank you, Denver. I mean, the website's livestrong.org, and they're going to find it be very simple, pretty straightforward website. There's ways to get involved, and it's literally, it'll say get engaged, and it gives you an option. It gives you, do you want to donate money? Do you want to participate in an event? And then there's another section that says, do I just want help? And if you want help, that's what we're there for. We do that to north of 300,000 people a year, and they're going to find 22,000 articles. They're going to find videos. They're going to find chat rooms. They're going to find all kind of resources there. But it's really pretty straightforward, and it starts at livestrong.org, and they can walk through the steps really easy. I would just encourage people to take that first step. Once they do that, they'll be rewarded. They'll get the information and the resources they need to be successful in their cancer journey.
Well, fantastic. Thanks, Greg. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Always a pleasure to be here, Denver, and thank you for hosting this. A great job of sharing the pluses and minuses of charities in the public world. Thanks again.
And that is this week's show. We'll only be on stream next week. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Remember, November 28th is Giving Tuesday, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.